Prodigy is a production of iHeartRadio.
Our galaxy contains billions of Earth-like planets. With so many opportunities for life, how could we possibly be alone? Everything is very spread out and far away, but it's also been around a long time. 1,000 civilizations could have colonized the entire thing by the time we discovered fire. So the question is, where is everybody? This is the Fermi paradox, and there are several theories that attempt to explain it. Perhaps an event destroys civilizations before they can spread out, like nuclear war or a deadly virus. It's a concept known as the Great Filter. Frighteningly plausible, but it might not be ahead of us. It could be behind. Maybe getting this far at all is a trillion to one odds. But if Earth isn't rare, and intelligent life is common, the fact that we can't see any could be the most terrifying thing imaginable. What if they are there, but they're being very, very quiet? If you look at our own history of how we've evolved, killed, consumed, and conquered to become the dominant species on the planet, it's obvious that we are extremely dangerous. If we encounter others, it's likely they've done the same thing and are also dangerous. We've advanced enough to be kind of civil and want to be their friends, but communication is extremely difficult. Sending a message from one planet to another takes decades. We don't know if they're friendly, and they don't know if we are. Whoever strikes first will probably destroy the other. It's the first strike advantage. The media depicts interplanetary war as invading fleets, but none of that is really necessary. All they'd have to do is fire a small object relatively close to the speed of light at us, and the energy created on impact would be like 1,000 nuclear bombs. If a planet in the galaxy has a civilization just a bit more advanced than ours, they could have the technology to fire these missiles at every planet they see with intelligent life. When threats are unknown, you need to be cautious. You don't call out. You're either very quiet or you're dead. Because the forest is dark and there are predators. This is Prodigy. As a child, Alan knew that stars weren't just dots in the night sky. They were the porch lights of other people's homes. And it was frustrating that adults never seemed to pay much attention to them. When he discovered science fiction books and shows, they filled his mind with wonder. While other kids were studying math and history, Alan was discovering humanoid creatures who could communicate with their minds. In the sixth grade, a teacher told his mother that Alan needed to stop reading those books because it was hurting his studies. Alan was devastated, but he still wondered about things. Why did the moon appear to be the same size as the sun? Science said it was a coincidence, but he knew better. At university, Alan was reading James Joyce when he came upon a sentence that sent a bolt of lightning through him. "Welcome, O life. I go to encounter for the millionth time the reality of experience, and to forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated conscience of my race." At that moment, Alan knew that was his mission as well. He would bring his awareness to others. In 1987, Alan set off on a road trip to scout the perfect location where he would take part in the Harmonic Convergence, an event where people around the world would meditate at the same time, activating a new age of universal peace. In Sedona, he attended a channeling event. When a woman named Jane walked past him, he could feel her energy vibrating. They were inexorably drawn together. Not long after, they were driving along the highway through western Nebraska, and exhausted from a long day on the road, decided to pull off into the farmlands to find a place to sleep. They rolled into a quiet dirt road and parked. That night, Alan Steinfeld was abducted by aliens.
We felt like in the night we were frozen in place. I mean, who even remembers that kind of thing? You know, I don't remember the position I went to bed in and I woke up, and it's not something that stands out. So anyway, he had that experience. And then I also had this mark on the back of my leg, this four-prong puncture mark, which, you know, might be strange. I didn't see it. Actually, I came back home and my mother said, "What's that little marking there?" I said, "Oh, it's nothing." And then I met some people connected to the Bud Hopkins intruder groups. And I just asked them about this. I said, "You know, is this anything that has shown up before?" And they said, "Yes, that is an abduction marking." It kind of freaked me out.
When Alan heard that the unexplained mark was from an abduction, he decided to take part in a hypnotic regression to see what he could learn about that night.
In this regression, there were beings that had appeared. You know, what's so weird is that there is a trauma associated to this, and traumas are not easily accessible by the conscious mind. So anyone who's had any kind of trauma, war, they used to call it combat fatigue. And so the trauma is encountering beings that are not in our worldview. We don't consider them real. And then when you do encounter, there's a part of the conscious mind that disassociates. The disassociation is the activation of the trauma.
Hypnotic regression therapy is used by some clinicians to treat repressed trauma by accessing the subconscious mind. Alan thought he couldn't remember how he got the mark because of the trauma it created.
I got back to some of that in one regression and saw these beings opening the back door of this van we were sleeping in. And that's sort of as far as I've gotten or willing to get, because I wasn't ready to go into that realm. But I might be now. I might be now. So my experience was based on it was a physical marking, a vague notion. And then after that experience driving cross country, I did have these dreams of these beings showing up. And it was dream-like. But, you know, dreams, they just fade away as you get up. But some dreams you never forget. Those are dreams I don't consider normal nocturnal hallucinations. There's something happening in an altered state.
The mind is a powerful thing, and dreams can seem quite real, especially when we aren't fully asleep. Listen to the Lucid Dreaming episode to learn more.
Yeah, I had these dreams of this little being handed to me, this, and I think it was a hybrid. So I think they take our genetics, they mix it with theirs, and they create these little hybrid beings because they need our genetics to evolve.
Alan believes that aliens need our DNA so that they can use it to evolve. This creates hybrids. He knows it sounds odd and doesn't have any evidence that could possibly convince a skeptic like me, but he still believes it. And one reason is because of channeling.
There's something about consciousness that transcends the hardware. Your brain is your hardware, your personality is your software, but you know, if you're at a computer, you need more than hardware and software. You know what you need?
Internet,
yes. But more than that, you need an operator. So it's like, have you ever seen a dead person? There's the brain there, but there's no activity. There's nothing there. There's nobody home. There's no operator. So I think the operator is transcendent.
Channeling is when someone can communicate across space and time. This is like a medium who communicates with the afterlife.
Bashar is being channeled by Daryl Anka, who goes into a state and picks up this other frequency. It's like a radio, you know. The formation of that signal is not from the radio. It's being received by the radio or an internet or the phone. Our brains are receiving signals, so he just switched his channel a little bit and picks up Bashar, who's this being, this extraterrestrial being, who's talked about, yes, there's been this hybrid program.
Daryl Anka is one of the more interesting characters I discovered along this journey. He was a visual effects designer for movies like iRobot, Pirates of the Caribbean, and Iron Man. In 1973, he had two close encounters. Quote, "I had close range, broad daylight sightings of UFOs with witnesses present both times. At each sighting, we saw a dark metallic, triangular craft, about 30 feet on each side. There were three blue-white lights, one on each point, and one orange-red light in the center." This event kicked off Daryl's study of extraterrestrials. 10 years later, he began to learn about channeling. In doing so, he was able to connect with an alien named Bashar. Daryl is able to connect with Bashar by achieving gamma state. Gamma state is the highest frequency our brainwaves can achieve, and it's quite real. It's often called flow state. Think of it like being in the zone. When Daryl achieves gamma state, he can tune to Bashar's frequency, like a radio. Bashar is a contact specialist, basically an ambassador to new worlds like ours. He's from a planet called Esasani, and has revealed to Earth, through Daryl, the four laws of creation, which are meant to help us recognize our true nature and function. Number one, you exist. Two, the one is all and the all are one. Three, what you put out is what you get back. Four, change is the only constant, except for the first three laws. In 2015, Alan invited Daryl to be on his YouTube channel, New Realities.
So you've been channeling for Bashar for
24 years.
24 years. And what I'm curious about is the process of what you do to tap into that other place in order to bring this entity through. Just describe that.
Yeah, the connection process, as I understand it, is kind of a telepathic contact. And what I've been trained to do is change the frequency of my own brainwaves to be something closer to the level in which they exist. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, Bashar will do the same thing from his end, so that somewhere in the middle, the brainwave frequencies meet and lock together. Mm-hmm. And what you then get is his thoughts translating into the language that I obviously was raised to understand, which is English. He's not speaking, he's just sending thoughts, but I'm translating that because our wavelengths are synchronized.
After a brief introduction, Alan prompts Daryl to channel Bashar. Daryl takes off his glasses and takes a sip of water.
This is exciting. I don't think anyone's ever actually channeled on the program during the interview.
Daryl slowly turns, looks at him.
No, go ahead.
And chuckles, then adjusts himself to begin. He covers his face in his hands to refocus, takes a deep breath, wipes his nose, and coughs. He interlocks his fingers, twitches once, then sharply exhales. Another twitch, cough, twitch, breath, twitch, cough. His clasped hands pull apart, and he brings his fingertips together. After 30 more seconds of deep breaths, twitches, and coughs, suddenly, Daryl connects with Bashar.
I'll take a day to you this day of your time. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here.
It is our pleasure always to co-create these transmissions with each and every one of you. For in
Bashar speaks with his eyes closed, his fingertips together, and with an accent that comes and goes.
What would you like to discuss this day?
Well, first of all, the sort of the process, because I talked to Daryl a little bit about what happens. Are you waiting on this other side for him to just go to that space?
No real waiting is happening on our behalf because we can instantly sense when the connection needs to happen. We may be having this communication with you in what you would consider to be your past or your future. So it doesn't necessarily interrupt our time frame when you decide to do this.
So you aren't busy doing something else like having lunch or something and then decide?
No, besides which we don't eat.
Okay, tell us where you're from, who you are, basically what time frame you exist in.
We are in what you might call an alternate dimension of reality.
Bashar explains that his people are genetically related to ours.
So where's Earth now, 300 years in the future?
It is, in that sense, a planet that has changed.
In 300 years, our planet will have changed drastically, but we'll interact with the Esasani. Bashar is here to help us make the transition into the Federation of Planets.
So you've said in the past, one third of the population has been abducted by gray aliens in order for your experiment to be carried out.
It is not our experiment. We are the result of the experiment, and it is not exactly an experiment.
All right.
It is the idea of the continuation of their race through the utilization of your...
So the beings abducting us are not aliens. They are mutated humans from a parallel reality called the Grays. They destroyed their civilization and ability to reproduce. So they take our DNA in order to evolve. This creates a series of hybrid races, one of which is Bashar's people, the Esasani.
I mean, I feel in harmony with you and very much in touch with
them. Alan mentions that he feels like he's already been genetically altered for the last three generations in his family.
Maybe three generations in my family.
Ten
generations, thank you. And they've done this in order to take genetic...
Then he confirms that the Greys have done this to match the genetic frequency that they want to integrate. Bashar says yes, and reminds Alan that it was by agreement, whether he remembers it or not.
Actually, I don't really remember all of it, although I do have vague memories of this little being placed in my hands.
Yes.
And that was one of my...
Early hybrids.
Early hybrid children, in a sense.
Yes.
I see.
Different degrees of genetic material will wind up in different hybrid children.
Mm-hmm. So I've had a lifetime of abductions, basically, would you say?
If you want to look at it that way, or you could say you have a lifetime of co-participation in a very large-scale program that will benefit your world immensely.
Well, I don't
know. It depends on how you wish to look at it.
No, I'm actually very honored to be the father of an alien race. I think that's...
We thank you for your participation, without which we would not be.
Right, and I think
great,
it's...
Great, 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 great grandfather.
You mean we're related?
Distantly.
Uh-huh. Meaning some of my genetics went into Bashar.
Not directly, but into the lines.
Uh-huh. I love that. Thank you. Could I talk to one of my direct descendants?
No.
A little over 45 minutes into the interview, Bashar thanks us for taking part in the link.
And... we bid each and every one of you, individually and all of you together collectively, a fond, exciting, passionate, and creative good day.
Then with a sharp exhale and a jerk of his neck, his hands snap apart, and the link is broken. Daryl rubs his face as if waking up early from a nap.
How did it go?
Thank you. How are you? It was beautiful.
I'm fine. I'm waking up.
No. I got a lot of... energy.
Back to my interview with Alan. He explains his theory on channeling.
What's the source of the energy that's feeding your brain to say these sounds, to listen to these words, to comprehend it? What's the source of that? It's not just neurological activity. That's the hardware. What's feeding the hardware? That's the mystery here. And I don't have an answer for that. I just say that maybe consciousness is non-local.
Bashar's message is all about self-empowerment and achieving the life you desire. He recently offered us a gift, the Esasani Contact Crystal. The crystal can be yours at a low, low price of $175. The Esasani have bills to pay too. I wonder why the Esasani haven't visited us yet. The distance between stars is large, and we understand that the speed of light is a universal speed limit. But Alan actually figured out a way to travel instantaneously.
Einsteinian physics says, yeah, there's a speed limit, but quantum physics says that there's instantaneous association. Einstein called spooky action at a distance that he could not explain how objects could travel instantaneously from one place to another beyond the speed of light. And that's because in quantum physics, they say there's an entanglement property. You affect one spin of electron here, it affects another one beyond the speed of light, beyond the distance of a light year or somewhere else. So look into that if you want to understand how we possibly can travel faster than the speed of light.
I listened to this fun and informative show about physics called Daniel and Jorge Explain the Universe. Host Daniel Whiteson is a particle physicist and a super nice guy who came on to explain how it works and if it can be used for faster than light travel.
Quantum entanglement is a really fun and fascinating and super counterintuitive concept. It actually comes out of a thought experiment by Einstein, who was trying to show that quantum mechanics is nonsense. He was trying to come up with an idea, an example of how it leads to something which shouldn't make any sense. But then people did the experiment and they discovered actually it doesn't make sense, but it's also real. It's like the way the universe actually works. And what happens is that you have two particles that have their fates connected. And that happens when you have like two particles that come from a single process. So there's some like constraint on what happens to them. for example, you have a photon and it generates for you an electron and an anti-electron, then those two particles have to have opposite electric charge because their electric charge has to add back up to the electric charge of the photon. So they have this constraint, this connection between them. And so the way you make two quantum entangled particles is you have a situation like that with a constraint. And often you'll have it, for example, on the particle's spin. So maybe you have a particle with no spin and it decays into two particles that do have some spin. So then their spins have to cancel out. And so you have one particle might be spin up, the other one in that case would have to be spin down. Or if the first particle is spin down, then the second one has to be spin up. Now the quantum mechanical part arises because you don't know which one is spin up and which one is spin down. So imagine you create these two particles. You don't know which one is spin up and which one is spin down, but you know that only one of them can be spin up. Now you separate them really far away. One of them is a mile or a light year away from the other one. And each one still has the chance to be spin up or spin down. Now look at particle number one. You open the box, you ask, is this one spin up or spin down? And the universe decides at that moment. It's not like it was secretly spin up the whole time or spin down the whole time. It was uncertain. It had both possibilities existing the whole time. And then when you open the box and you ask, is this one spin up? Then the universe decides, yes, this one's spin up. And what that means is that the other particle, which is now really far away, a mile or a light year, instantaneously becomes spin down. So you have two particles separated by distance. Both have a possibility to be spin up or spin down, but the entanglement means they have to be opposite. So when you measure one, the other one suddenly goes from being uncertain to being definitely the opposite of the first particle. That's quantum entanglement. And we don't understand the mechanism for that, how that happens, if there's some like quantum accountant somewhere that's like, you know, making all these things add up. But we know that it does. We've done the experiments. We see that this actually happens in real life.
Was there any way it could be used for faster than light travel?
I understand why you might think so, because there is a factor in there which is instantaneous. If you open box number one and you find out that now the particles spin up, then instantaneously the other box goes from being undetermined to being definitely spin down. So that feels like maybe there's a way to get around the light speed limit because there's some sort of instantaneous communication happening there. That is true. However, it is not possible, definitely, absolutely not possible to use this property to send any information across the universe faster than the speed of light. And that's because we can't control what these things are. All we can do is observe them. So you can't, for example, take box number one and force it to be spin up, which would make box number two spin down. So you can't like manipulate box number one in a way that affects box number two. All you can do is ask the question, what's in my box?
Well, do you think there's any way we could travel faster than the speed of light?
Absolutely. There's a lot we don't know about the universe. This rule seems pretty hard and fast. It's like encoded deep, deep into the bedrock firmament of physics. I would be pretty surprised if we discovered any way to send information faster than the speed of light. Einstein showed that if you send information faster than the speed of light, weird stuff happens, like causes can come after effects. You know, like you can be hit by an arrow before you even shoot the arrow. Crazy stuff like that. So I think it's pretty unlikely we're going to find a way around moving through space or sending information through space faster than the speed of light. But there are some loopholes that I think we could use to affect the same results. Like if what you want to do is send information between here and a distant place and you want to do it basically instantaneously, you can't do it by sending information through space. But you might be able to do something like bending space, right? Your goal is not necessarily to actually go through all that space. Your goal is just to get the information from here to there. And one thing we have learned about space is that it's not flat. It's not just like a background where things happen. It can bend and ripple and do all sorts of weird things. And so, for example, you might be able to build a wormhole. A wormhole is a shortcut through space. And if you can connect our local space to some distant space far away, then you don't have to break the light speed rule. You just sort of like made a shortcut. Wormholes are theoretical. We've never seen one, but there's nothing in the laws of physics that prevents them from being real. We've seen space being bent. That's not theoretical at all. The sun bends space. The earth bends space. You bend space. We're bending space right now. And of course, black holes bend them most dramatically and show us how bending space leads to all sorts of weird effects, like light getting trapped, right? The reason that light is trapped inside a black hole is not because the gravity is so powerful it can pull on even massless photons. It's because it's bent the shape of space so much that every step forward is actually towards the center of the black hole. So space is this weird, malleable thing, and you can bend it to your will, perhaps. And one day we might be able to build wormholes that connect us to where we want to go. So we don't have to travel through space less than the speed of light. We can just travel a short distance at whatever speed we want and still get to our destination.
Instead of aggressive advertisements, brain-blasting capitalist consumerism, let's talk about something you might actually like. Daniel and Jorge Explain the Universe is a podcast that explains the scientific secrets of the universe. Since podcasts don't require eyeballs, you can do other stuff while you listen, like cleaning that impressive layer of dust off your ceiling fan while you learn about everything we do and don't know about the universe. It's hosted by Daniel Whiteson, a particle physicist and professor at UC Irvine, and Jorge Cham, a cartoonist and engineer whose dad jokes can totally beat your dad's dad jokes in a fight. So, if you want to gain 30 IQ points, listen to Daniel and Jorge Explain the Universe wherever you get your podcasts. Back to Prodigy. So, if they're technologically advanced enough to reach us, why are there only random, isolated, and unverifiable sightings akin to Bigfoot, instead of something public like landing on the White House lawn?
Because I think they don't want to upset the population, even though they are upsetting people when they're taken aboard these things. But the general population needs to slowly integrate the idea that there are craft here, that there are beings from other places, other dimensions here. It's like if you hit them all at once, we don't know what to do with that information. You know, there were studies in anthropology called the cargo cults when these Europeans used to land on these islands in the South Pacific, and they'd come off out with all their equipment and all their, higher technologies. And societies would dissolve because they weren't ready to integrate this new phase. We've developed over the last 100 years. We need to integrate those things into our society. And this is what happened in those cargo cults that started to worship these Europeans who had this higher technology, and the society dissolved. So I think that's one lesson from history. We can see that if a higher advanced civilization interacts with a lower advanced civilization, meaning us, they're shocked and stunned. And so maybe technology has been given to us slowly over time in order to integrate these other beings in our awareness. That's why they're not showing up all at once, because they're basically compassionate. If they wanted to invade or take over, whatever they are, I'm not even saying they're aliens. I don't know what they are, but there's something out there. And if they were to show up all at once, we would be freaked out.
They're slow rolling their introduction so we don't freak out and start worshiping their magic. That's a logical argument, but it depends on if you believe the people who have had encounters. Is it possible that they're just grifters, lying to make money off the mentally vulnerable? Even if there's no evidence, if someone reputable has seen it, then it holds more weight. There actually has been 3 recent sightings from Navy pilots. The incidents are known as FLIR, or Nimitz, Go Fast, and Gimbal.
Like a lot of scientists today, Neil deGrasse Tyson said, all the stuff they're seeing on radar and all that is just an apparition of the radar itself. And has he listened to the Navy pilots say, well, we saw something with our own eyes and it just disappeared? These are trained observers. So what do you think? Do you think they're hallucinating? What do you think when Navy pilots come out and say they've seen stuff?
Occam's razor, it's, I think, a simpler explanation as opposed to intelligent life coming and visiting.
But that is the simplest explanation, really. I think that is much simpler than trying to say these 4 pilots were hallucinating. It was something we can't explain in our airspace. I'm just curious, from a skeptic's point of view, why is the idea of aliens visiting this planet a hard one to grasp? That seems like the Occam's razor, answer.
Well, nothing would make me more excited. It would be the greatest discovery in the history of mankind.
Absolutely. That's why we're talking about this. But what makes you think it's not that?
But I need evidence.
You don't get evidence to disprove something. You only get evidence to prove something, right? The evidence. So what evidence do you have that it isn't aliens?
But I don't have any evidence that it is aliens, though.
As a well-meaning jerk, occasionally I debate people about the existence of God. They'll often say, you can't prove that God doesn't exist. This is the point in the conversation where I say, the burden of proof is not on me. The burden of proof is on the person making the claim.
Maybe you're right. We can't say it's alien, but we could say what Elizondo says it is not. Luis Elizondo, you know who he is? He came out on 60 Minutes, Washington Post. He can say they're not Russians, they're not Chinese, and they are not ours. And they do not seem to be made by any country on this earth. He doesn't mention the alien word because when he does that, it puts us in a whole other ballgame. But if it's not Russian, Chinese, or ours, who's developing these incredibly technically sophisticated aircraft that can speed away at 80,000 miles an hour that do not seem to have any propulsion system? Who's doing that?
We'll get into that. But first, let's see how UFOs came into our culture. This is Toby Ball, host of the podcast Strange Arrivals.
When people take a look at sort of the modern UFO era, right, it goes back to 1947. And that was when, in rapid succession, a guy named Kenneth Arnold saw, he didn't really call them discs or saucers. They looked more like sort of boomerangs almost. But he said they skipped across the sky like saucers on water, I think is the way he put it. And that saucers thing got picked up, so they were called flying saucers, which is an interesting thing in and of itself, and that sort of drove what people were seeing in the skies afterwards. And then it was just very shortly, I think less than a month after that, Roswell happened. What happened with the Betty and Barney Hill thing and why they are really important in UFO lore, this happened in 1961. Up until then, there were people who claimed to have interactions with aliens. They were called the contactees, and they were mostly talking about basically human aliens coming from like Venus or Mars or somewhere in our solar system and landing with like a message of peace. Some people wrote books where they had these like crazy space adventures with these people, but it was sort of like a kind of like a Buck Rogers type of thing. Like, I don't think, it's hard to imagine anybody took it super literally. So what happened with Betty and Barney Hill is that their story was just markedly different. There wasn't this message. The beings were clearly not human. They were alien. And their interaction wasn't like a chat. You know, they were abducted. They were brought onto a spaceship. They had an exam performed on each of them. So when that was done, and I think when it was put forward to the public and the public found out about it, it just seemed like a different in kind, right? It seemed like, oh, okay, this is like genuinely mysterious and it doesn't seem like it's some kind of weird sort of allegorical story that somebody's trying to get a point across with. This sounds like a real encounter with beings that are unknown to us. From that point until, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, which is sort of when the whole alien abduction thing kind of run its course. As far out and as wild as things got, they still kind of harken back to these essential elements of the story that the Hills told. And I think that's one of the really, you know, remarkable things about it. Like, whether you are a believer in their story or a skeptic or whatever, they somehow, between the two of them, created this framework that was so compelling to so many people that it really drove a lot of what we think about aliens and UFOs and certainly believers in alien abductions. It all goes back to this one, you know, story or incident between these two people in 1961.
The humanoid extraterrestrials known as the Greys that Bashar described earlier were popularized by the Betty and Barney Hill abduction and inspired thousands of similar abduction claims along with appearances in film and television. Although they didn't enter the mainstream until that 1961 abduction, they actually appeared in literature as early as 1891. In fact, they appeared in an episode of The Outer Limits just 12 days before Barney described them under hypnotic regression. In the US, they are described in 73% of all abduction reports. So we can trace back how the Greys entered our folklore. But for most people, I'm assuming the archetype has been long played out. But an article published in 2017 changed that. This time there were sightings of spacecrafts on video. And they weren't from random people. They were US Navy pilots, who are known as trained observers.
Who's made this technology that these, at least go back to 2004, the Nimitz, are seeing? I mean, what other explanation? I'm interested.
Should we now accept that aliens are not only confirmed, they're also here? Or is there a simpler explanation? To explain this phenomenon, I spoke with Mick West. Mick has a YouTube channel where he provides factual explanations for conspiracy theories like UFO sightings and chemtrails.
This object doesn't actually move on screen except when the camera moves, and it resembles an out-of-focus, low-resolution backlit plane. I don't know what the pilots saw, but this video does not show anything really interesting. The gimbal video is also probably of a plane. It's not rotating. What you see is the infrared glare of the engines, which is larger than the plane. It looks like it's rotating because of an artifact of the gimbal-mounted camera system. Oh, and the aura around the plane, that's just image sharpening. It happens all the time in thermal camera footage. It's not an alien warp drive, it's just the unsharp mask filter. The Go Fast video probably shows a balloon. It's not moving fast, it's not skimming.
The recent stuff, how did that start? That was kind of like, in a way, the mainstreaming of UFOs, and it started in 2017 with the publication of an article called Glowing Auras and Black Money in the New York Times, which was a story about this program within the Pentagon, a program called ATIP, A-A-T-I-P, and that was started by Senator Harry Reid, and it went to his friend Robert Bigelow, who is a eccentric millionaire, I guess would be a good way of describing him, who's really interested in the paranormal and in aliens. Ultimately, that's why we are where we are today. There's been sightings of UFOs for many, many years. But the one kind of iconic sighting that we're talking about here is the Nimitz encounter of 2004, which is a long time ago, 17 years ago now. So it's kind of an old one, even by UFO standards. The Nimitz battle group was off the coast of San Diego, and they were having radar issues where they were seeing these targets on their radar, which were these very slow-moving targets that were moving in groups of five down the screen from north to south, and they couldn't figure out what it was. They thought maybe it was a radar glitch, so the people thought it was like some kind of ice cloud or something like that, cirrus cloud. And eventually they sent people to see if they can intercept one of these, and then the pilots who went there had some kind of encounter with some kind of object that they called described as a large tic-tac shaped object. And then later another pilot went out and he took some video, a very, very blurry video of a distant object that looks vaguely tic-tac shaped. It doesn't really look like tic-tac shaped. But this is, I think, a whole mythology has grown around this encounter. We don't have very much in terms of actual data from it. For many people, it became this iconic encounter with a UFO that convinced them that UFOs were real. So you could definitely point to that as being one of the starting points of a modern UFO flap.
When I think of the most qualified people to observe these sightings, I immediately think of Navy pilots. How does that factor in?
Pilots are trained observers, but what they're trained to observe are other planes. I've had some pilot training and they teach you what they call these scan patterns where you scan the sky. You have to look at various different segments of the sky, because if you just look forward, you get this kind of blindness in your field. So you have to keep looking. So you're trained to observe the sky, and you're also trained to and also scan your instruments. So you have a scan pattern for your instruments, and you combine the two. But what you're trained to look out for are other planes, so you don't bump into other planes, or in the case of military pilots, other planes, because they're often hunting or avoiding other planes, and of course, you know, the other planes that they're flying in formation with. So whenever they see something in the sky, they naturally assume it's another plane. And if they see something that's an unknown, like this tic-tac-shaped object, I think the natural inclination is to think that it's the same size as another plane, 40 feet long, which is exactly what David Fravor said. He says, I've seen a lot of Hornets, which is the type of plane, the F-18 Hornet, the Super Hornet, and that's what the size he thought it was. I think he just naturally assumed that's what it was. But it could be any kind of size. Like he said, he thought it was 40 feet long. It could have been 20 feet long. Or it could have been 10 feet long. He could just be misjudging the distance, which means he would misjudge how it moved and how fast it was moving and how far away it was. So yeah, you're trained, but you can't train people to observe something you've never seen before. It's always going to be a novel experience.
The term UFO is being replaced with UAP, which stands for Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. In pop culture, the term usually means aliens, but describing something as unidentified doesn't necessarily mean another civilization. It just means we don't know what specifically it is yet. It could be a plane, a balloon, or 100 other things, but we can't say for sure without more information. Alan isn't alone in his beliefs. He's part of the New Age movement, which you'll hate to hear me say, because people involved have rejected the term. While he is on the more extreme side of it, the movement has thoroughly permeated Western culture. Think about how many people you know who say they aren't religious, they're spiritual. The belief goes far beyond sightings. Alan's book is a collection of essays from sources representing a variety of eclectic occultist influences.
What's been found in underground in Antarctica, if you've listened to some of these people coming out, like Linda Moulton Howe, she's mentioned in the book, she's did a whole bunch of shows on what whistleblowers have told her what's under the ice in Antarctica, which is this complex cavern of ancient hieroglyphics that they can't explain.
Linda Moulton Howe's first memory of contact was while she was playing outside during the summer of 1952. She loved looking at the moon, and the full ones like this always made her gasp. As she stared, all sounds faded away, and the moon appeared to be getting closer. Then suddenly, she was on the moon. Then inside it. It's hollow, she discovered, and it's watching us. Then she was back to her position on the lawn. She shares an excerpt from a book written by William Mills Tompkins. Quote, it has been known for thousands of years that the moon is not a planetary moon. It is a hollow moon station that was built out in the galaxy by one of the federations, towed into Earth orbit and parked with one side facing Earth. First, it's not our moon. Planet Earth is not our planet. We're just allowed to use it while working for them at slightly above the slave level. The moon and Earth both belong to several entities out there. Tompkins also believed that World War II was an extraterrestrial war fought through human bodies. The Nazis partnered with the Vrilya ETs, who then went to inhabit deep underground cabins beneath Antarctica. But they discovered they weren't alone. Large reptilian humanoids and smaller gray humanoids were already there. The three mixed and matched genes in already evolving humans.
I like to look at what cannot be explained and try to explain it. I'm not saying what I'm saying is true. I think the human intelligence has always put out hypotheses about certain things. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. But that's what we are as creative, inventive beings. We're always trying to explain reality, and we always have to keep revising our explanations. Thomas Kuhn's, he says science gets stuck in their paradigm because they don't include anything outside of it. They call it anomaly. But he says anomalies are what push scientific investigation. You have to incorporate things that don't fit into your worldview into a bigger worldview. It keeps pushing the envelope forward.
This argument from New Age prophets that the reason scientists don't believe that aliens are here and abducting them is because it conflicts with their current paradigm is a bad faith argument that shows their complete lack of understanding on the subject. Discovering intelligent life would be the greatest discovery in the history of mankind. It's what scientists dream of. I don't believe we're alone, but there's absolutely zero evidence that they're here. I asked my fellow skeptics if they believed intelligent life existed.
I'm totally open to it. I would love for that to happen, but you gotta have more convincing evidence. You gotta have some actual evidence, something concrete we can explore, something multiple scientists can, you know, get their hands on and play with. I'm desperate for it to happen. I'm totally open-minded.
Yeah, there's two things about that. You know, I personally would like that to happen. But also, if it was happening, it would be super significant. It wouldn't just be like, oh, there's aliens. Oh, okay. Like, it would be, holy crap, there's aliens. Everything we know about the universe has changed, and the future trajectory of human existence has been irrevocably altered in a way that no one expected and is entirely unknown. And there's all kinds of possibilities and dangers that we now need to consider. So the idea that the government is, you know, covering up this thing, as if it's like just some small thing they can just cover up. Oh yeah, there's aliens, but you know, we're not going to talk about it. It's ridiculous. As if there's aliens, it's the biggest story in human history. Not just like simply because it's like super interesting, but because it would change everything. It would change, you know, transport for one thing. Let's just look at one real simple thing, transport. Everything we know about transportation would change. We wouldn't, you know, be needing to use fossil fuels anymore. The F-35 fighter program would be completely obsolete. You know, $1.6 trillion program, completely obsolete. So if these things were actually true, if it was this revolutionary thing that is actually there, the government would be spending billions and billions and billions of dollars investigating it. It would be the most serious thing that's ever happened. Not just the US government, all the governments, you know, China, Russia, like Iran, Brazil, like Argentina, Australia, Great Britain, France, all the governments would be prioritizing this as the most important thing to look at ever. But they're not. Nothing is happening. Hardly anything is happening. There's like, you know, a crappy little program to theorize about what the future of aviation might be, which also studies UFOs just in case they have some clues. And that's it. So I think that really indicates the level of evidence that's actually there and available to the government. There's nothing to disclose. There are things in the sky, sometimes we don't know what they are. But we're not on the verge of disclosure of a new paradigm in human existence.
Unlike science, Alan fails to recognize his existing bias, and instead seeks to reinforce it any way that he can. He always believed there were aliens since he was a child. He was already part of the New Age movement when he had his encounter. Now, I like Alan, and I don't think he's lying about what he believes, but his arguments are logical fallacies. Daryl Anka, on the other hand, is an outright con man. He preys on vulnerable people and sells them hope and rocks. His performance isn't even believable. It would be funny if it wasn't so messed up. I reached out to him to come on, but he never responded. Daryl, if you're listening, if you're not a grifter, then come on the show and prove it. You won't, though, because conveniently, you can't. But back to reality. It's difficult to make assumptions on how common intelligent life is in the universe because we have a sample size of one. Since the only planet we experience did develop intelligent life, it makes sense to assume that there are more. And the Dark Forest answer to the Fermi paradox is based on our current level of technology. It's definitely possible that intelligent life is so far different than us, or so much more advanced, that we simply cannot see or comprehend it. The example commonly used is, could you explain what a freeway is to an ant? So while there are plenty of reasons to believe intelligent life exists, there's no reason to believe they're already here. I think this breaks down to the different ways people's minds work. We've evolved to reduce uncertainty by making connections in our minds. If someone has a custom framework, then when they see something they can't explain, they'll conform it. The ironic thing is that they make an identical argument for why others don't agree with them. The only difference is that they have zero evidence and expect us to disprove it. New Age spiritualism is based on partially rejecting the rigid religious paradigm that existed at the time. I rejected the one I was presented with as well, but I don't need to replace it with more nonsense. The universe is chaotic. Our existence doesn't require a god or anything else to be meaningful. The sheer fact that we exist against such odds is worth celebrating. And instead of reaching out to the stars for validation, we should be quiet and wait, because the forest is dark and there could be others like us. Thanks for listening to Prodigy. If you want to share your thoughts or experiences, then reply to the tweet of this episode. My handle is LowellB85. Alan seems well-intentioned. If you want to hear more interesting theories, pick up a copy of his book, Making Contact, and check out his YouTube channel, New Realities, to learn more about what we know and don't know about the universe from someone more qualified than myself. Listen to Daniel and Jorge explain the universe. Not only is Daniel incredibly knowledgeable about physics and an excellent speaker, he's brilliant at making complex subjects easy to understand, which is no simple task. check out Mick West's YouTube channel, where he breaks down the Navy pilot videos, along with a lot of other conspiracy theories, in a logical and digestible way. Pick up a copy of his book on how to respectfully debunk conspiracy theories with facts and logic, called Escaping the Rabbit Hole. He also has a podcast called Tales from the Rabbit Hole and a forum called metabunk.org. If you want to connect with me, visit prodigypodcast.com, where I have links to all my socials. I love hearing from people. Special thanks to Gianna for voicing the intro. Prodigy was created and produced by me, Lowell Berlanti. The executive producer is Tyler Klang. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Become a part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry with an education from Trinity School of Natural Health. Trinity graduates can empower their communities through natural health principles and techniques, whether they go into practice to guide others toward their wellness goals or open a store to sell their favorite health products. Trinity grads are equipped to change lives. With 19 online programs and flexibility to fit your busy schedule, including the popular Certified Natural Health Professional, you can get the training that helps you turn your passion into a career. And here's the best part. You can earn the certification in less than a year. From herbology to naturopathy and health coaching, Trinity allows you to make a meaningful difference by helping others live healthier, happier lives. Don't wait any longer to pursue your passion for natural health. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.